Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
You know, with everything that I've gone through with the arena, depression, you know, I've got to throw PTSD into it now as well because I've got that. You know, this will be my third year now without any medication, but it's a daily battle.
If you don't focus on yourself and you're allowing other people to control you, then that's when you're not going to survive.
For every day for that year, just waking up to like terror, bewilderment, frustration and despair. That's a place where I wanted to die every day.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome back to Mental Health Monday and the second of our podcasts coming from It's Mental Live here at the University of Bolton Stadium. Last week's edition of the programme was recorded in this little room that I'm in now, just overlooking the pitch. It's the media room. But actually, this event is actually being held over three floors. You've got the floor that I'm on now, which has got, just down the corridor, there's an oxygen chamber. Then there's like a yoga space and there's all kind of exhibitors going on there. There's 150 exhibitors in total. Below that, there's the second floor with other exhibitors, people with from great organisations, local and national as well. Notice the Papyrus team here today, a great organisation doing their best to prevent young suicide. I'm sure we'll be speaking to them in the upcoming weeks. And then on the ground floor, we've got the main arena space. Now, that's where you're going to be hearing this week's podcast coming from. So a live edition of Mental Health Monday, live on the arena floor here at the University of Bolton Stadium. 1,000 people through the door as well, so we had a really good crowd for this one too. And some fantastic guests and some brilliant interviewees coming up for you as well. It's a panel, so it's more than one voice this week. Among them, Martin Hibbert. Now, Martin is a Pride of Britain Award winner. He was a survivor of the Manchester Arena bomb blast, and last year he climbed Kilimanjaro. Now, Martin's in a wheelchair, so it was an incredible achievement for him to do that. But he talks about the spirit of hope, bringing people together as well. He also talks about his mental health previous to what happened at the Manchester Arena as well. So he's a really great guest to kick us off today. Martin Hibbert on Mental Health Monday. Zee Jogi is with us as well. Now, she's a Guinness Book of Records holder as well, and the first British Muslim woman to have this incredible record of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. She's done it too, but also to take part in an obstacle course at the peak, which is absolutely huge. She's also recently as well back from an endeavour to Everest as well. We'll hear about that too. Her charity is called Z's Defence Academy, and it's all about self-defence, but also using physical exercise to change people's mental health and life outlooks in general as well. So we'll hear from Z on the programme too. Also joining me on stage, Lee Chambers. Now, Lee's a top man. He's a tech entrepreneur. He's gone through some really difficult times as well. He got ill back in 2014 and lost the ability to walk. His mental health at university was significantly impacted as well, which knocked him back. But he's regrown and re-stepped forward at each of those opportunities. Now runs an organisation called Essentialize, which he founded in 2019. Lee joins us on the panel as well. And then we've got a former DJ, Young Lee, joins us on the show. Now, Young Lee has been a world-level DJ. He's worked with brands like Ministry of Sound, Google and Vogue. And he talks about changing paths as well after a spell in rehabilitation. So he'll talk about the issues that he has been through. He's now a 12 steps counsellor. So we've got Young Lee on the panel. We've got Lee Chambers. We've got Zee Jogi. And we've also got Martin Hibbert. And we'll start with Martin's story as we cross over to the stage at It's Mental Live 2023. And actually, Martin, as a Bolton lad, returning to Bolton to tell his story and telling us just how where he's from plays an important part in the way he sees life.
I think so, yeah. I think people who follow my story will know. I've said, I think it is a Bolton mindset, a northwestern mindset. You know, my grandparents worked in the cotton mills. My dad was a police officer. My mum worked full-time. So I spent a lot of time growing up with my grandparents. My granddad was my role model, you know, and he told me from a very early age, you know, never wait for your ship to come in, row out and meet it. You know, if you want something, you go out and get it. And that's just been me. I've always been successful in pretty much whatever I've done. And I know that, you know, life's never easy. There's always bumps in the road. And my granddad used to say, there's two ways you look at it. You sit and mope about it, or you do something and you get on and do something about it. And I've always done the latter. And I think if it wasn't for that, I don't think I'd have survived the arena bomb. I've been very You know, there was even thinking that night, there was no way I was going to die on a cold concrete floor. This wasn't going to be where I'm going to die. And that kept me alive as well as other things. But it has been instilled in me. You know, those, I suppose, a lot of now are old-fashioned values, but my granddad was, very central to that.
I mean, in terms of what happened that night, I think I'm right in saying you were the closest survivor
yes.
to the actual blast, which yeah. goes to show just how close things were. And I wonder, when you think about that, that phrase of being the closest survivor, does that fill you with horror, or does that fill you with a thought, well, thank goodness, you know. How do you compute, really?
It's a good question, because that kept me awake for a long time. And I actually found peace with that in July 2021, when I was giving evidence at the inquiry. And as part of that, I got to see the footage before, during and after. So I saw everything. And I saw a picture 1 second before detonation, and I was 6 metres away. And then I saw the picture afterwards where everybody around us died instantly, yet me and Eve survived. I'm not religious, but there must be a reason. And I think part of that reason became clear at the top of Kilimanjaro. The reason why I've survived, and maybe the reason I've survived. My best friend Steve, who you will have seen on the documentary, he always says, I'm not religious, but Steve always says, God puts his most difficult battles on his most bravest soldiers. So maybe that's why I've survived, because he knows I'm from Bolton, I've got a big gob, and I can change the world. But it feels right, and I'm just using my story, my profile now, to bring about change, especially in the disability world. So I'm a big disability advocate, and people know I'm lobbying governments at the minute, and the government have asked me to get involved in one of their new disability campaigns. So everything that I'm doing now is, because I could quite easily just go into a shell and go, do you know what, I'm going to sit in a corner and cry. And people would probably go, yeah, go on, we'll come and join you, but I'm just not that way.
When we talk about that, though, there's a balance, though, isn't there, to, you know, the sitting in the corner
yeah.
and there's just trying to find a new pathway. And then there's what you did,
which yeah, probably,
is like,
I'll probably go a bit
what should I do next? And it's, let's go and climb Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
How many people said you can't do it?
Or, oh, loads.
Like, physically impossible?
Yeah. But, you know, they told me that Eve, my daughter, wouldn't see, hear, breathe, speak, walk, and she's doing all that. You know, and I don't want to be dictated by this wheelchair that I'm in. So I can do anything that I want to do. What I've got to do is find people that will support me in doing it. And that's the issue. Unfortunately, in the UK, we have a real bad perception of disability, and it winds me up. I'm still the same person. This has actually made me more stronger and more determined, which actually is quite frightening. And that's what it's about. What I'm trying to do now is change the perception of what we have in the UK on disability. Let's embrace it. Let's celebrate it. Look at what people can do in a wheelchair. I was told I won't be able to climb Kilimanjaro. Two of my able-bodied friends couldn't do it. You know, only 60% of able-bodied people do it. Yeah, I became the second paraplegic to do it.
Wow. And actually, this has been mentioned a few times today. We'll mention it again. Resilience. So actually, that idea that it was something that you probably already had, you talked about your grandparents, that you
yeah.
maybe already had it in you. And actually, when we talk about the benefits of having a really positive outlook when it comes to our mental health, that's actually something that maybe you had before, you know, the arena attack. That was something that you had in life. And actually,
yeah.
you had to make every withdrawal in the bank that you'd placed on it
Correct.
To get you where you wanted to be. But you'd banked enough of it, if you like, to get yourself where you needed to go.
No, of course. I do a lot of motivational talking now, and you know, a lot of people will have seen my story about everything that happened with the arena, but what a lot of people don't know is that I was diagnosed with depression in 2014, and I've had a real journey with the mental health. You know, I was 2 days away from committing suicide. You know, a lot of people don't know that, you know, and I've had to seek help myself. I had to turn my back on the NHS literally 6 months before the bomb, yet 6 months later, they were the ones that were saving my life. And again, if it wasn't for that journey, you know, I don't know if I'd still be here. you know, with everything that I've gone through with the arena, depression, you know, I've got to throw PTSD into it now as well because I've got that. But I've been, you know, this will be my third year now without any medication. But it's a daily battle. A lot of people don't know about the mental health journey that I've done, so I'm slowly talking about it, getting it out there. So, you know, with everything that I've gone through with the arena, as well as having depression and PTSD, it is a daily battle.
And that's the thing that some people might think, oh, your story begins at, you know, 2017.
Yeah, no.
And actually, that mental health journey
3 years before that.
Before that.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the thing about unknown stories,
yeah,
untold
exactly.
stories that people maybe don't know. Let's bring Z into the conversation. Z, it's a pleasure. Mount Kilimanjaro, I notice you nodding along. So you've embarked on a Kilimanjaro trek yourself.
Yes.
With an obstacle course, a world record-breaking obstacle course at the top as well.
That's correct.
Now, as somebody who runs a self-defense academy, again, that would be enough. That's great work in a community that makes a real difference. But there was obviously something in you that was thinking, there's a challenge here, and it must be something about heights or
That's
summits
correct.
That make you want to conquer them.
Yeah, I do love altitude. So I sort of conquered everywhere in the UK, from like Scarfell to Ben Nevis to Snowdon a couple of years ago, and I've done them like 5-6 times each. And as everybody, during lockdown, my mental health was severely affected. I think for me, it was more not being able to go to the gym and train and work out. And that mentally just got to me. And all I did was went on to Google and put extreme challenges. And Kilimanjaro came up. So, yeah, so it took a lot of training. And, yeah, I completed it. But to be honest, it was the hike itself was a big challenge. I got altitude sickness and dizziness, I was hallucinating, it was crazy. So getting to the top in the crater where I seen the obstacles, I was like, I can't do this. And I remember sitting on the side of a rock saying to myself, eating banana soup, saying, I can't do this, you know. But then I just thought, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? Like, I'm going to die. I'll just die with a Guinness World Record. So I did it. And yeah, I became the first British Muslim in the UK to have completed this challenge.
Which is just incredible. And in terms of that, what is it in and of yourself that made you think? Because actually, what you'd done up to that point was enough, but you obviously felt that there was something more, and you obviously found it within yourself just to push that a little bit further. And how many people in their daily lives just hold back from that push? Because you know what, it's easier not to do that push, and yet the payoff from making that push must be absolutely huge.
Yeah, it's mental discipline, and I think we've got to be positive, and I think that's something that I'm taking away in my whole life. And I think for me, it's the martial arts training. It's given me discipline and, you know, just to focus on you, because if you don't focus on yourself and you're allowing other people to control you, then that's when you're not going to survive. So for me, it's more the mental resilience, it's mental strength. But I did not ever think in a million years that I'd be sort of achieving like 2 Guinness World Records sort of on this mountain.
You mentioned there, actually, and I really wanted to touch on that. From a mental health point of view, self-defense is your sort of your physical version of that, if you like. And you've just hinted at it there, that actually, from a mindset point of view, the first stage in self-defense is awareness of yourself. And that's a really crucial thing that sometimes people maybe don't take from everyday life. They always think, oh, it's everyone else around them. But actually, the first thing you need to think about is yourself. That's a big mindset shift for some people to make, I bet.
It is, yeah, and I think for me, it's training in martial arts from a very young age, at the age of 15, and I'm still training now, and it's only recently we've set up like a charity, sort of teaching other women, you know, to train martial arts. But I wouldn't even say it's martial arts in general, it's a hobby. You have to do something you enjoy, whether that's reading a book, doing some knitting, going for a walk, it could be anything, but make that a habit, make that a hobby, and that hopefully will turn to passion and addiction, and that will keep your sort of mental state strong. Without my training and, you know, having that mental strength, I won't achieve any of the challenges I've achieved so far.
What do people say to you who go through your academy, who learn those skills of self-defense? You know, they've got skills so that if they are attacked in the street, they know how to respond, or if something happens within the home, they know how to respond. And you hope that they never need to know that, and maybe they never even use it. But there's something else that's going on, isn't there? And that, I guess, is that sense of, I'm prepared if something does happen. And that idea of that you prepare for an event is into the conversation we had with Martin around resilience and being ready for when difficult things do happen, you've got a skill set to get out of.
Yeah, and it also teaches you confidence. So a lot of women that we sort of teach are vulnerable, and they're lacking self-confidence. They don't feel like they're good enough because they've been put down their whole lives. So through the course and meeting other inspirational people and talking about stories and experiences, they get empowered, that they feel confident and that somebody does believe in them. And this is what we're trying to give out to all people, you know, within the community, is it's never impossible to do anything. You've just got to have the focus and to take that step, which sometimes is hard, but with the support around you, I mean, there's so many organisations here today that, you know, just having that little conversation, getting involved in a group or an activity, you know, will do you wonders.
Oh, absolutely. And I've said today, you know, there'll be conversations that take place today that will change someone's lives, maybe completely, but maybe just that little thing that makes things a little bit different. We'll come to Lee in a few moments' time, but while we're globetrotting, let's bring young Lee into the conversation. You've had an incredible sort of music career that's taken you sort of far and wide, and you've worked with some like incredible names as well. For yourself, along that journey, people presume you were living a hedonistic lifestyle and it was, you know, long sunny days or great nights. For a time, is that absolutely true? Is it absolutely the case that, you know, as a dance DJ, when the dance floors are full and the clubs are bouncing, that things are looking good for you?
Yeah, absolutely. For many years, it was exactly that, hedonistic, going around the world and all the rest of it. But unfortunately, my drug addiction, because I used to be a drug addict, was kind of hand in hand with the success, you know, and the ego as well. The ego going massive, and that's a horrible place to exist in, because actually you think you have everything, but you've got nothing, because inside you're dying like someone on the street, you know.
At what point do you think, hang on a minute, there's a problem here? Because I guess there's loads of people saying, you're great, you're fantastic, let's more. You know, there'll be people booking you because they want that thing that you're delivering. But then there must be a point where you realise maybe that there's something that's not quite right?
Oh, absolutely. I was thinking when you were talking about suicide, and I remember the last year of my drug addiction, for every day for that year, just waking up to like terror, bewilderment, frustration and despair. You know, and that's a place where I wanted to die every day, even though I have all the material things, a nice partner, and, you know, and what I know today after my, I hate using the word journey, but journey, is that throughout my life, I always try to find happiness, desperately trying to look for happiness. I need happiness, looking for it in the pipe, the bottle, the needle, whatever, women, gambling, all these things. And for me today, what I know is, it's about being useful. The more useful I am, happiness just comes as a byproduct of that. That's what I've found out. I mean, it's not new. People have been doing it since the beginning of time. It's just new to me.
I think that's really interesting. Actually, that idea of being useful. But that was that down, do you think, your own... Was there a maturity point where you thought, actually, my use to other people is something else? Did that come with age, or was that a particular experience?
For me, I needed to be broken so I could let the sunlight in. It was only through my brokenness, through my desperation, that I was able to get on a completely new path, because I didn't know there was another way to be. I thought it was life was all about getting the house, the money, the car, all those things, success, all those things that didn't bring me any peace, didn't bring me that internal joy or that serenity. And so it was only out of that brokenness, that gift of desperation. I know it's a gift today. Look, listening to other people's story, I know desperation can be an absolute gift, although it doesn't feel like it at the time. It's horrible to feel desperate and broken, but I can see now that's a gift, if you're able to kind of grab it.
I wouldn't ask you to name any names here, but do you recognise within the sort of the field that you were in, other artists who maybe are going through what you went through? Do you sometimes, when you maybe read little things in interviews and think, there's something else going on there?
Yeah, I know many that are in the grips of, we call it the madness of drug addiction or alcoholism. I attend 12-step fellowships, and within those, I know many guys in the industry that are either trying to get well or, you know, or are well today, are recovered drug addicts or alcoholics, yeah.
And in terms of that, taking steps forward, when you tell your story and you offer your experience and people see where you've come from, how do they respond when they see, you know, they may have seen you in action, you know, like, it must be quite something that they're thinking that it's going to be like a man or a woman wearing a bit of a suit and they're going to explain something quite clinically to them. And actually, for you to explain your story must offer a completely different insight to them.
Yeah, definitely. I work in the field today. I'm a counsellor and I lecture in addiction and the 12 steps. And, you know, that's the power of me talking to someone who's suffering from the illness that I suffer from, because a doctor, as fantastic as doctors are, they don't suffer from this illness. So they still can't do anything for it, you know, because it's a mental condition. It centres in the mind. So especially people that used to see me out there, you know, living their very hedonistic lifestyle and saw, you know, when I looked like I'd just been dug up with bones sticking out of my cheeks and see that I'm a very different person today. Because not just I don't drink or I don't use drugs, but I'm completely different in every way. My attitude, my behaviour, my reaction to life is very different. So that's quite, I don't want to say inspiring, because I don't want to sound ego, so it helps people.
I can say it's inspiring. It sounds inspiring to me. There's that Bros documentary, it's called When the Screaming Stops, and it focuses on that moment where as a boy band, you step off stage, you have your high point, you step off stage, and then it's everything that happens after that one. And I wanted to ask, particularly given the experiences of you guys, about that. Yung Lee, you first in terms of that, because physically you're on stage, and then you're off, and then there's all the other stuff. Martin, from your point of view, in terms of Kilimanjaro in particular, you had your heart set on something. The same with yourself around, I've achieved the thing, but then does that come with a decline? Is that something we've got to be so aware of, that when we do set ourselves up these highs and we hit these highs, there was the Will Smith line, wasn't there, that Denzel Washington said to him, that's when the devil comes for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know today that I live a spiritual life today. So within the word spiritual, we've got the word ritual. You know, in the morning I do meditation, I pray, I do other certain things that helps me. My life isn't really high or really low. It's just kind of like that and like that, you know. So I think certain things that we do, disciplines that I do and other people do, help me to stay kind of like that rather than extreme, you know.
Martin, that return to Civvy Street, if you like.
No, one of the things I wasn't expecting when we came back from Kilimanjaro was the come down from it. And I think, you know, the Kilimanjaro project, I had this thing in my life for almost 2 years, you know, getting trained, getting ready for it, doing altitude training, you know, getting strength and conditioning. We did Kilimanjaro, and then I woke up one day and I didn't have this thing in my life anymore. And a few of the team, we had this, I could feel myself going into a depression, but because I know the signs now, I know what to do. But I'm very similar, where I have to keep myself busy. The danger of that is I take too much on. So it is a very fine balance. But if I don't have anything to look forward to, or I have a target or something to do, that's when the demons come. And like I say, that's when the devil comes for you. So the reason I keep myself busy, it's almost kind of an internal mechanism to keep the demons away, especially not being on any medication. Now, I've got to be really careful with that.
Let's bring Lee Chambers into the conversation. Lee, thank you for your time as well. I think it was less than 10 years ago, illness meant left you unable to walk. Your mental health declined around your university as well, which is, I know, was my own experience. My last year of university, I now recognize that being a time which was incredibly difficult. I thought at the time it was me just not being able to cope with life. I just thought that was just adult life wasn't sort of made for me. I understand it now to be, you know, a depressive episode, but you had a lot of other issues that were going on in your life. Can you just set up maybe where you were sort of 9-10 years ago?
Yeah, so I think the best way to kind of, you know, frame it is actually the start of this conversation about us being sat here as inspirational people. And while others might see us as inspirational, you know, I grew up on an estate a mile down the road. We're just humans. Everyone is human, and everyone is capable of amazing things. Sometimes it just requires adversity to really see what you're capable of, and sometimes, quite often, unlock even more of yourself than you knew that you had. So for me, I, you know, grew up in Bolton. I was the first one in my extended family to university. I went off to the big city, to Manchester, thinking, you know, I was going to make it and, you know, become an adult. And actually, my mental health declined quite badly at university, and I've spent the last 18 years managing my mental health through a variety of different ups and downs. When I came out of university and dropped out due to my mental health, I took a year working on myself and managed to get back, re-enroll and graduate, and managed to get on a graduate scheme at a national bank and then think again that I had a life pathway to follow. I lost that graduate scheme in the recession in 2008 and had to try and reinvent myself. I went off to Manchester to a person who's, you know, relatively well known, very successful in business, and I said I wanted to set up a business. And as a 21-year-old black lad with a northern accent from Bolton, he told me that, you know what, Lee, you're black, you're young, you've got an attitude problem, you haven't got much of a network, you'll not make it. So I spent the next 5 years proving him wrong and built a video game business that grew across Europe. But as you just alluded to, around having a real intense focus to prove people wrong, that was amazing fuel. Unfortunately, the business got to a point where its relative success took me up one mountain in life, and the snowball that I built going up that mountain started to chase me down. My own success became what I feared. And to be in that place while managing a mental health condition was really challenging. And then to compound that, in 2014, my son was 18 months old, my wife was 6 months pregnant, and over the course of a few days, my immune system failed, and suddenly I lost the use of my body and ended up in hospital bed with a lot of time to reflect on, actually, what have you been taking for granted? What have you not cherished? And actually, you're going through a difficult time now, but what can you learn from it?
When you talked about being the first, you know, the first member of your family, you know, to go to university, I think sometimes we underestimate that because we look at it and we judge it by other people's standards. But actually, when anyone is doing something for the first time, when they don't have the people behind them who can go, this is what you do, this is how it works, when you've got to find that all out for yourself, there's big pressure that falls on people, particularly at those young ages, where you've got to learn it all and you've got to pick it all up. And one day you'll be able to pass that down, and that's great. But for now, you're the one who's got to fend off all the problems. You're the one who's got to, you know, as the boulders come in your direction, you've got to step out of the way and try and guess where the next one's coming through, because no one's going to tell you. Being the first, how difficult is that, and how difficult was that a part of where you wanted to be?
Yeah, so again, as an 18-year-old lad, you probably don't have a level of self-awareness that you've built and a level of emotional intelligence that is really useful to you until you start to explore that. Being the first one to university was a privilege, but it was also a lot of pressure. And there are many people across this world who don't have access to that level of education. And that weighed on my shoulders in some ways as well, knowing that some of my family who are out in other countries don't have that option, never had that pathway. So I was held up in some ways as a bit of a beacon in the community for what you could achieve. And that added quite a lot of pressure on my young shoulders. And again, not having someone to confide in to say, what's it like? Not having someone to ask, a role model to see that they've achieved it before. You know, very few black role models in academia, in science, that I could look up to when I was a young man. In fact, that contributed to my own mental health challenges, not having a bit of a blueprint, not having the support around me that I probably needed, and as well being a young man and not really able to express my emotions. So often your support networks, having representation and role models, and that's why, again, you know, some of the work and some of the feats that the people sat next to me have achieved, role model it to the next generation about what you can be, and whether it's disability, whether it's race, you know, whether it's the things that you've ultimately been through in your life, you know, being able to see that someone else has walked that pathway can give you belief that you can at least walk yours, even if it's not the clearest pathway available to you at that point in your life.
Z, can I ask you about that? Because in terms of Muslim women within family communities are very well known, very well respected, but actually within the wider population of, can you name 5 or 10 famous Muslim women, particularly who are involved in physical activities, people suddenly would go, oh, maybe I can't. Did you get that same sense that actually you were in a field and you were doing something which was not seen to be the norm, or wasn't a pathway which other Muslim women, maybe people you've grown up with, were taking?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially my self-defense and mixed martial arts training. It's been a very tough journey this last 15 years. And I still today get a lot of the cultural sort of, you know, men say, what are you doing? You're not meant to be doing this. You know, what are you trying to teach girls? Empowerment, confidence. They don't need that, especially within my own culture, which is quite upsetting. Because, you know, we're living in a Western world, and what I'm doing is actually providing services for females only as well. So I understand the cultural, you know, prospects of things, but you still get that, which is such a shame, because all women are capable of doing anything. And for me, is when I initially did the Guinness World Record, after that, the respect for myself in the community has just grown tremendously. And that, for me, has just been a breaking point. So I did that challenge for myself, but actually, it showcased to the community how powerful a woman can be, whether you're Muslim or not. You know, it's the fact that you're a woman as well. And that's what now I'm trying to show through our charity for other women as well, that never give up your dreams, you know, always focus, and, you know, you will be successful.
I wanted to ask you about sort of self-reflection, and actually, certainly from the conversations that we've had, and colour side, Z, periods of time where you've had, enforced or otherwise, a time where you've got to sit in a hospital bed or have nothing but your own thoughts to yourself, whether it's rehabilitation or whether it's an illness which you have no control over. That period, I wanted to ask you, how do each of you think back of that period of time? Martin, I'll start with you. Because at the time, obviously, you're thinking, right, what's going on? What's the next period of my life? When you think back to the amount of time you had with yourself, if you like, how do you feel about that period of self-reflection?
No, it's a good question. Again, people who follow my story will know that, like, the Martin Hibbert that say today is Martin Hibbert Mark II. There's two. And I look at the Martin Hibbert sat in a hospital bed, having, you know, nurses feed me, wash my hair, bath me, and I think my life's over. You know, I'm not going to kick a football again. I'm not going to take my dog Alfie. But that literally lasted about an hour. And then it was like, right, what do I now need to do the things that I want to do? And actually, I've just seen my medical report that they did at Salford Royal, and it says, we've never seen somebody as, we wish all our patients were like this. You know, I think at the time when they tell people they're not going to walk again, there's obviously tears, anger, probably a few expletives, things being thrown. There was none of that. It was just like, right, you've told me that. What do we do next? When does physio start? What do I need to do to get out of this bed? So there's I'd probably say I reflect every day about things that I do. You know, failure has always been a part of my success. So I've never been I've never been afraid to fail. So, you know, and I look at my failures, and it's always gone on to bigger things, bigger successes. So you've got to fail to be a success, but I learn from the failures. So I probably reflect every day now, and it probably just comes as a daily structure to my day. I think sometimes I overthink things, and I think that's probably one of the causes of my depression, was that I overthought things. And you know, what I used to think, what I used to do in a day, I'd be thinking about things that probably would never happen. So I probably reflect every day, and I would tell everybody to reflect, because you'll never learn if you don't.
Well, we touched on the 12 steps before. I guess the decision comes to take step one, and I guess that's a period of self-reflection where you have to think, right, I need to make a decision now to take this first step, knowing that there's a second step, and there's a third one after that.
Absolutely, and I was just reflecting actually on a time when I was in my second psychiatric ward, and very unwell, you know, to be thrown into a place like that. And I was watching some pop videos, and there was guys that I'd been working with not long ago, and there was me sat in a psychiatric unit. I'd lost everything, I had nothing, you know, and I thought, how did I get here? And then I thought, I've got two choices. I'm gonna go on the way I'm going, and I'm probably gonna die. I need to take another choice, and that led me to those 12 steps. And one of those steps is about prayer and meditation. And each day, every day when I start the day, I lie there in meditation, and I consider the 24 hours ahead. I consider my plans for the day. Well, I have to be like bamboo, because often they change. And at night, I go through the day. and I think about, was I resentful today? Could I have done better? Was I selfish? Did I harm anyone? But I think there's a fine line between self-reflection and overthinking and being too much in my head, because that's a terrible place for me to be, you know. So I think self-reflection is a fantastic thing, but not if I'm there sort of beating myself up and you know, sort of, you know what I mean?
I do a thing with my kids. I've got a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I do a thing where I say, what are your marks out of 10 today? And that's me trying to train them into thinking. And they'll go, a 6. And I go, why is it a 6? And it's somebody didn't play with me. Somebody said something mean to me. And of course, what do you need to make it a 7? And it's like, oh, a cuddle with your dad and all those. And it, for me, what I'm trying to do at that point is I'm trying to get them to think what, at the end of the day, to think, right, well, what worked for me? How did I feel about it? And what do I need to feel better? And then I hope that in the future, if they have, you know, 4 out of 10 days consistently, they'd start there and hang on a minute, I'm still 4 out of 10 here. I was at 6. What was I doing when I was a 7 and an 8? What was it that I was doing when I was a 9 and a 10? That gives you that sense. And like I say, their age is 4 and 8. And I'm hoping, but I think it's that thing, isn't it, of hoping that the reflection becomes a natural part of a daily cycle rather than overanalyzing everything that you do, something that I've very much been guilty of myself. Lee, in terms of that reflection time for yourself, obviously you used it as a springboard to then do things. How much of it was, though, was a reflection time for you thinking about yourself and what you wanted to achieve and what you hoped you could achieve?
Yeah, so I think, if I can be honest, initially ended up in hospital, and for me it was the guilt and the worry about my, you know, pregnant wife, my daughter who was due to be born, my 18-month-old son, and the complete unknown of whether I'd get back up on my feet or not haunted me in that first week, because really it was a time when I wanted to step up and be there, and actually suddenly I'd lost my independence, and I felt quite a lot of guilt for that, knowing that I couldn't control it, and actually felt a little bit hopeless about things. But what happened is I spent a month in hospital and, you know, a lot of tests, but no idea why my immune system had failed and started to attack my body. But what I did realise is I got moved up onto a longer term ward. I started to talk and express how I felt, and that helped me to start to understand and appreciate, you know, what I actually did have. Now, I was in Blackburn Hospital. When they moved me up to the top floor, I had a bed next to a window. Out of that window, I could see across the moors from Blackburn to Bolton. And I thought to myself, one day I woke up, looked out that window and said, Lee, you've walked across those moors a lot of times over the years. How many times were you grateful that you could walk? And that just sat with me. At that moment, I realised I had to do everything I possibly could to get back on my feet and recover so I could play with my children. My son would come and visit me at hospital. He wasn't speaking yet. He'd look at me with his eyes. His eyes would say, Daddy, why can't you get up and play? And during that period, you know, I went into walking rehab alongside a whole range of other people on a very similar journey. And what I'd realised is I'd come to a level of acceptance of what had happened. I couldn't control it, as in I couldn't control what had happened to my body and how my immune system had failed. But what I could control is trying to get the best outcomes for my recovery. And my daughter was born just as I exited walking rehab into intensive physiotherapy. And actually, that was a tough journey, but my daughter became my reason to get back on my feet. I wanted to take her first steps with her, and that became the very sole focus of my whole intention to get back on my feet on those days when I didn't want to, for the setbacks that I had. And I managed to get there. A month before she started walking, I started walking, and yeah, the rest is history.
Lovely little bit of synergy there in the family household. Absolutely. Earlier on in the conversation, I mentioned I think we've disregarded the word, or we've mislabeled the word selfish. That we've all grown up in a world where to be selfish is for you to take what you need and to dismiss everybody else. And I'm starting to relearn that word a little bit. And I think I've got a hint of it from each of you, that there comes a point in everybody's life where you have to say, right, well, what is it for me? What do I need to do to give me the right step? You're all nodded, so this is a good sign. But that being selfish doesn't have to mean put yourself first and disregard everybody else. It can also mean, Martin, I'll start with you, to put yourself first, knowing that a good version of you and the you version of you is better for you, and it's also better for everyone around you.
Yeah, I went through a similar, actually at the spinal unit, and the lady came in and she said, list all the most important people in your life. So I wrote down like wife, brothers, mum, dad, friends. She went, you've missed somebody. So I was looking down, I was like, wife, brothers, daughter, da-da-da-da. I went, no, I don't think so. She went, you've missed one. And there must have been maybe 10, 13 people. And we were there for half an hour and like, starting to get frustrated. She said, you've missed you. She said, you should be number one, because without you, all those people fall away. And it is, you've got to be selfish. And I think the word selfish probably isn't the right word, but you've got to be the best version of yourself. And that's what I do, you know. I don't think about what I did yesterday. I only think about today. I don't think about tomorrow because it's not here. I learn from what I did yesterday, but I can only control what I do today. You know, there were times where I'd be thinking weeks, months ahead. I kick ass today and that's it. That's all I can control. We'll worry about tomorrow. But yeah, probably the word selfish is the wrong word. You've got to be the best version of yourself, the strongest person, because everyone around you will fall away if you're not the best person.
It's that thing, isn't it? You know, when you're on the aeroplane and they say when the masks come, put your own mask on first before you start helping other people. And of course, every inch of you thinks, no, look after the kids. That's an important thing to learn, right? That you need to look after yourself. And if you start to notice that you yourself are struggling, that you are within your rights to take steps to then start doing the right thing for yourself, knowing that that will bring positivity and protect certain people around you from potential negativity.
If I don't take care of myself, self-care, I'm no use to anyone else. I need to eat well. I need to sleep enough. I need to exercise. I need to do all these things so that then I can help others. But I was thinking about the word selfish, and you know, one of the major things I can talk about myself is selfishness. But out of selfishness, it's the root of my problem. Actually, if you think about any spirituality, any religion, trying to cut away the self. Because out of that comes like fear. And I was speaking to I hope I'm not going off the subject here. I'll make it quick. This Native American guy last week, and he said in his belief there's two systems, either the love system or the fear system. Now for me, when I'm being selfish and not thinking of others, I'm in the fear system. You know, I went slightly off the point there, but. Yeah, we do need to take care of ourselves first so that I can help others after.
I mean, Z, you do self-defense, right? So that's you're not going, right, I'm going to teach you all how you can attack potential people coming down the street. You're actually saying, let's give you the power to look after yourself, and then if things do come your way, then you're equipped to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me as well, I've volunteered in the community for the last 15 years, as well as having a full-time job. And giving back is part of my religion as well, but I started losing myself, you know, like years and years went on and I was just kept giving and I never expect anything from anybody. But then I started to realize, and my family started to realize, that it was too much because I wasn't giving myself that time, which is when I had to step back and sort of evaluate my life and think, okay, what else can I do? Because I love volunteering, and this is the reason why we've set up the charity. Now we've got loads of volunteers here today helping, because we want to create leaders in the community. But if I'm not competent, if I'm not confident and strong within myself, how am I going to lead a group of people? So self-reflection, you know, come back to the point, as everybody has stated here. So I do a lot of journaling as well and write down thoughts, and I'm constantly just, you know, writing down things because that helps me sort of focus on the positives. Because even if you are going through a bad experience, remember there's always a learning behind from it. There's always a reasoning, and you might not know it at that point, but it will come to you in the next couple of months or a couple of years. And you remember thinking, wow, that happened for a reason, and this is the reason. There's always a positive out of a bad experience as well.
Do you get the chance now, Lee, to look around at the family and sort of think, oh, right, those first steps were worth it. You know, I'm glad that I'm still here. I'm glad that I persevered. I'm glad that you retrained, that you've got, you know, your own well-being business now, and actually you've put mental health at the heart of what you do because you know the value of it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I reflect back on what happened, and it didn't happen to me, it happened for me. I needed that hard stop and that reflection, and actually to kind of repurpose and recalibrate and realise what was important. And our health is, you know, the most important thing that we can cherish, that we can value. And to think about what you were saying about selfish, it's more of a case of how we lead ourselves. And we all lead ourselves. And leading ourselves well allows us to take others on that journey and to actually be a lot more collective and a lot less individualistic. And I suppose I reflect back now, and yeah, I can run around the garden and play with my children. Yeah, what, you know, walking with my daughter is a moment in my life that I will never forget. And for me, you know, I'm able to set that example to my children that they can go through adversity as well and grow from it and learn from it and actually embrace the challenges that life will naturally face and the uncertainty that will no doubt come their way. And now I bring that into my work. I'm able to empower others to make choices, decisions, to prioritise the health when they need to, but also look out for other people. And, you know, hopefully everyone in this room is on that journey as well. And yeah, even an event like this just allows us to come together and actually support each other a little bit, because each one of us who gives a lot also needs some time to get a little bit of energy back from others, plug ourselves in with great people, recharge and enjoy ourselves.
Lee there, wrapping up our brilliant panel of guests from the It's Mental Live arena floor. And like I say, 1,000 people through the door for It's Mental Live 2023 at the University of Bolton Stadium. It was a real pleasure to host that main stage as well throughout the course of the day. We had some great guest interviewees as well, both in the from the BBC and also within Bolton Wanderers in the community as well. So thanks to the team who got involved in that, to Stephen Robinson as well and his team that made It's Mental Life such a huge success and invited Mental Health Monday to be part of it. As ever, you can find mental health services where you are. You can head to the Hub of Hope, www.hubofhope.co.uk. Type in your postcode there, you will find mental health services close to you. Don't forget the usual numbers, 116 123. If you want to speak to the Samaritans, you can text SHOUT to 85258 as well. If you want to get involved in the SHOUT Network's text service, they can engage with you over text message if you want to talk to somebody about your mental health. And some of those wider organisations you will also find on the Hub of Hope. Don't forget, in an emergency, the number to call is always 999. Mental Health Monday is back next week. Thank you for checking out the podcast. If you're able to share it, drop me a tweet. Let me know that you've been checking out the program as well. It'd be great to hear from you.